The title of this morning's sermon is Enjoy Your Streams. And then the next slide. I want to show you this slide. That's the title of the sermon. Then the next slide. Okay. This is a beautiful stream of water. Happens to be in Israel. And it's in northern Israel, at a place called Banias. And this in the slide is one of the sources of the Jordan River. It flows out of the bottom of a hill, the base of a hill, about a foot deep, how many meters would that be? About 20 meters wide or so, just out of the base of a big rocky hill. And it flows down through this lush bush. And you see trees of various kinds growing along the edge, and in the distance you can see evergreen trees, tall, and so on. It's such a wonderful place. It's called Banias because there is a cave near where that water comes out from the base of the hill, and the water used to come out of the mouth of the cave. And so it became a place of worship to the Greek god Pan. Now, there was an earthquake. It doesn't come out of there anymore. The cave is still there, but the water comes out at the base of this hill. When I was there a long time, when I was a graduate student, I was in Jerusalem for the summer. And I had been to the Dead Sea. It was very hot. And I had been down in the Negev, around Hebron, where it's dry, dry, dry. And this country knows two seasons. The dry season and the wet season, which is the way it is some places in the world. Dry season, wet season. And so the Bible speaks about the early rains and the later rains. Early rains are like November. And the later rains are like in January, February, February. So I was there from May until August, and it never rained. And so I thought, so dry, and south of Jerusalem, like you need to water things if you want them to grow there. And then friends took me on a picnic. Yeah, you can drive the whole length of the country in part of a day. So we went up, had a picnic not so far from here, and they took me here, and I thought, the contrast between the drought and the water and what the water accomplishes. Here is an example of what water can accomplish. And since I'm talking about Psalm chapter 1, I wanted to introduce my thoughts with this particular slide. So we can go to the next slide. You've got that visual image, right? Good. I want to talk about the first Psalm this morning, and I'm interested in really just one phrase in this Psalm. The phrase is, they're like trees planted by streams of water. In fact, I need to go back to the translation which I made. Well, I tweaked it. This is really from the translation that's in the Bible in your pews. It's from the New Revised Standard Version. So here's what I've done. I've tweaked the translation a little bit. Happy is the person who does not follow the advice of the wicked, or take the path that sinners tread, or sit in the seat of scoffers. But that person's delight is in the law of Yahweh. And on his law, he or she meditates day and night. That person is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in its season, and its leaf does not wither. In all that such individuals do, they prosper. The wicked are not so, but are like the chaff that the wind drives away. Therefore, the wicked shall not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For Yahweh watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. Okay. If you were reading along in the translation, you'll notice I changed some of the wording. Happy is the person that, or blessed is the person who. Two things I'm going to explain. First of all, this they or he or she. The New Revised Standard Version, like a number of modern language translations, gets around gender-specific language by changing singulars to plurals. And so here in the very first word of the Book of Psalms, happy is the person, I guess it's the second word, happy is the person or happy is the man. This is in the singular. So it's addressing individuals and envisages individuals reading it. To read it as a plural doesn't offend the psalm, but it loses something in changing singular to plural. Now this comes up again in the book of Job. And if you read the book of Job, you know Job and his three friends, they're arguing with each other, and the argumentation is quite pointed and quite personal. But when you change them to plurals, it loses its edge. So here too, I think, in the first psalm, because it begins with speaking to the individual. Now, happy is the person. And now we have, like, don't follow the advice of the wicked. Don't take the path that sinners take. Don't sit with scoffers. The basic principle of Hebrew poetry is parallelism. Two lines, oftentimes two lines, the second line repeats the same thought as the first. Now, here we have a variation on that. We have three lines, which are more or less synonymous. And the wicked, the scoffers, the sinners, these are synonymous terms. But their delight, it goes on to say, that person's delight is in the law of Yahweh. Your translation and the translation in the pew will say Lord with four capital letters. Now I'll explain this briefly to you. Those four capital letters, the word Lord is capitalized that way because underneath that word in Hebrew, there is a word which is probably to be pronounced Yahweh. It's a Y, H-W-H. Because Hebrew, classical Hebrew, and modern Hebrew newspaper in Jerusalem, it just prints the consonants. And you're expected to know the vowels. And you can fill in different sets of vowels for the same letter sometimes, and the word will mean something different, but you have the context, and so you know what the word means. When it came to this particular word, Y-H-W-H, Jews did not pronounce this word because it was too holy to pronounce. So they would not say it. They would use, there were another number of options. One was to use the word Lord, which is Adonai. Or you could say simply the name, which is Hashem in Hebrew. So if someone was reading in the synagogue and they came upon this word with the four letters, they would say this other word or a different word. And over time, the pronunciation was lost. So we don't know how to pronounce it. What they did, one of the options that you could take would be to take the consonants, the sacred four consonants, and then add to it the vowels from the word for Lord. Does this sound complicated to you? Take this word that has four consonants and put in the vowels from another word, which means Lord, and you come up with something like, well, you come up with Yahweh. I need to backtrack. You come up with a word that sounds different, with kind of a new word. And the word Jehovah, in old translations of the English Bible, comes from that. It has the four consonants, but it has the vowels from a different word. So it's a word that never existed. Further, in English, well, the word comes from German. So you have Jehovah, but because German doesn't have a J, but when it comes into English, you have J instead of Y, and then you have Jehovah. Okay? So it doesn't matter if I lost you along the way. We know something about how the word was pronounced because there was a Christian scholar of the 3rd century named Origen who produced a great big huge book in various columns where the first column was Hebrew letters. The second column was in Greek transliteration. So he transliterated this Hebrew word, and so we have some idea how it was pronounced. All of that to say that this is not the usual word for God, which in fact is a plural in Hebrew. It's pronounced Elohim. And it's thought to be a plural of majesty. It's a singular translated God, but really it's a plural. It's not that word. It's not the word for God, the general sort of generic word for God. It's this word, which is the personal name of God. It's the word that was revealed to Moses on Mount Sinai. Well, the burning bush, when Moses is going to be sent back to the Pharaoh, he says, who shall I say sent me? And God says, tell him that Yahweh sent you. It's that word. It's the personal name of God. And that's of interest, too, because here in the first psalm, we have the individual. And the individual is devoted to the law of Yahweh, personal God. That's of interest, too. So this psalm is the first psalm of 150. So it's the door through which you go to all the other psalms. So it's an important psalm. Now the book of Psalms is a collection of songs that was used in ancient Israel, used in various kinds of situations. They're not just nice little poems. Sometimes they're poems of matters of life and death. They're poems of anguish very often, either of the individual or the community. There are psalms of thanksgiving. And so the book of Psalms is really tied to the book of Leviticus, where you have all of that information about the sacrifices you use on particular occasions. This gives you the songs that were sung. Some of the psalms would have been used on those occasions. There are psalms that we might not expect there. Psalm 15 and 24, these are entrance psalms. When you go to the temple, and there's kind of a who goes there, and then you have to know the answer. They're entrance liturgy psalms. When you go to worship, there are not 40 questions, but there are a few questions. And Psalm 45 is a song written for the wedding of the king. Psalm 45. If you've got married, if any of you have been married, you could look at Psalm 45 if you're intending. Psalm 45. This is a song for the wedding of the king of Israel. The largest category of psalms, types of psalms in the book, is the cry of the individual, or the complaint of the individual, the lament of the individual. There are like a third of the psalms are of that particular type. The individual comes in pain and agony, loss, cries out to God. Now, I'm reading Psalm 1, but if you look at Psalm 3 or 4, both of them are of that type. And these psalms have a particular structure. There's a way to write a song. So the address to the Lord, the address to Yahweh, and then the nature of the difficulty. The person is sick, that's often it, has been betrayed by enemies, or is being pursued by enemies. And this psalm almost invariably ends with some word of deliverance, of praise, anticipating that it's going to turn out that way. For example, Psalm 3, verse 8, deliverance belongs to Yahweh, may your blessing be on your people. So this little thing at the end, which gives the worshiper courage to go back and face whatever they're facing. Eventually, the psalms were brought together from smaller collections to the big collection. Now, till we get to Psalm 42, this is the David collection. And many of them are said to be a psalm of David, whether the psalm was written by David or it's connected with David, it's the David collection. There's another few psalms from Psalm 120, which are called psalms of ascent, for going up. And it's thought that this collection of psalms were songs that pilgrims sang as they went up to Jerusalem. There are teaching psalms, like Psalm 1, it's the first one. But eventually, these various collections are brought together into 150, and those which were psalms of ascent put together connection with David, put together many of them in the first collection. And then we have Psalms at the very beginning. You need an introduction. In Psalm chapter 2, which is about the coronation of the king of Israel, when this psalm came to be read in a messianic sense, here it is at the beginning. It too is kind of a door into the Psalms. And then Psalm 1 is an introduction to the whole book of Psalms. So you come into the book of Psalms through this particular psalm. At some point along the line, the book of Psalms came to be studied as God's revelation to us. But initially, they're the songs that individuals and congregations sang to God, weren't they? But at some point, they themselves become studied and can be read to be studied. And so this particular psalm, Psalm 1, derives from that time when the psalms have come to be read as God's message to us too, not just us to him, but God to us. And that's important. Because, let me read just a bit here. Happy are those whose delight is in the law of the Lord. Whose delight is in the law of the Lord. What is the law of the Lord? And notice that the word appears twice. Their delight is in the law of the Lord, or Yahweh, and on his law. So that word's repeated, so it's emphatic. What is the law of the Lord? Some of you know the word Torah, which is transliteration of what this word means. And the Torah in Judaism is the books of Moses. It's the law, and the first five books are considered the law of Moses. So here, it's that. But this law, but this word takes on a bit broader meaning. It can be referred to as the instruction about God, instruction about Yahweh, what Yahweh has given. And one Jewish scholar went so far as to say that this word could even be translated religion. It could be even religion. Now, it's important that this word instruction appears there because I mentioned how many books in the books of Moses? Five. And if you look through the book of Psalms was organized in groups of five. If you look after Psalm 42, and after Psalm 72, and after Psalm 89, and after Psalm 106, there's a little doxology at each of those points. So the book of Psalms falls into five groups on analogy to the five books of Moses. So here, we could say even the book of Psalms falls into that category of the Lord's instruction. Now it says, if I can continue, on his law, that person meditates day and night. That is all the time. Day and night is all the time. Meditating, thinking about, it can involve a kind of a mumbling, speaking out loud, reciting out loud, like some of you may recite the Lord's Prayer out loud, or passages of Scripture that you have memorized. So here, too, meditation may be the verbalization of words, too, not just have them in your head. So this person is thinking about God's will all the time, meditating on it all the time. Okay, I think I finished with that slide, so we can go on to the next one, see what's there. Okay, there is another slide, the two ways. You notice I skipped the bit about the wicked. Happy are those whose delight is in the law of Yahweh. They're like trees. And then it goes on toward the end of the psalm, the wicked are not so. So we have, on this side, we have the righteous, not identified by word until we come to... I look at verse 6, watches over the way of the righteous. Verse 5, second line, congregation of the righteous. So we have the way of the righteous here and the way of the wicked over here. I think the psalm, and for our interest too, is more about the way of the righteous because the wicked are not interested in the ways of God. So this is primarily directed at the righteous. The two ways. This is a way of instruction, isn't it? Jesus uses it quite often. Got the broad road, got the narrow road, got the big gate, got the small gate. It's a way of instructing. They're opposites. They're placed in two camps for the purpose of emphasis, drawing our attention. There's a lot of gray in life, isn't there? Have you found that? Like, I don't have so much trouble with this is the right thing to do and knowing this is the wrong thing to do. It's all the stuff in the middle that's so difficult, isn't it, and challenging. God gave us minds to think with, folks, you know. But the interest is primarily to address the righteous. And maybe as a caution, here's what happens to people who don't choose the right way. The righteous. Who are these people? It's such a difficult word. We hear it used pejoratively quite often of people who are self-righteous. And we don't like that. That's not a good thing when people are self-righteous. So the word righteous comes with kind of some baggage for us sometimes. And I must admit, over the years, many times I've thought, well, how can we explain who the righteous are? And I was just looking at a commentary a couple of nights ago on this passage, and the commentator said that the righteous are those who are what they should be. The righteous are those who are what they should be. It's not so much a list of, it's not an ethical issue so much as the demands, fulfilling the demands of a relationship. So the righteous are those who fulfill the demands of what God wants us to do. And I like this. The righteous are those who are what they should be. So this is about those people. And they're said to think about God's instruction all the time. And now we come to what I really want to talk about. I mean, this was just all introduction to bring us to this line. They're like a tree planted by streams of water. And so we can go on. Great. We're like trees planted by streams of water. So I've been thinking about this for a few weeks, a few months. So I guess I've been meditating on this very song, thinking about what is that, planted by streams of water? What is that like? What does that mean for us? Now, you notice it says like. So we're going back to your high school grammar and the difference between a metaphor and a synonym. What's a synonym and what's a metaphor? So remember this? So Miss Duffy, my grade 12 English teacher, in the grammar it said, this was the example of metaphor. The moon was a ghostly galleon. I know, it's kind of, it sticks in your mind. That's the moon was a ghostly galleon. So that's a metaphor. If it had said the moon was like a ghostly galleon, that would be a synonym, wouldn't it? So this is a synonym. The righteous, I know. Am I bringing back bad memories for you? No. Miss Duffy was okay. So this is a synonym. Those who are the way they should be are like a tree planted by streams of water. It's a comparison. This is a water in a dry land, right? An oasis. Now the streams here are not necessarily like a brook or something, or the stream that I showed you, one of the sources of the Jordan River. It could be a canal. And I think the next slide will demonstrate that. So here we are back in hot, dry land. We're in Jericho. And Jericho, the town, I don't know if it's a city now, but it's an oasis. And it's there thanks to a powerful spring. And Jericho has been inhabited since 7500 BC. I mean, it's an old place. When you say the old town, I mean, it's an old town. And it's there, and it's still there because of this powerful spring. Now, in Jericho, if you've got water, you could grow things. And so there's an abundance of water from this spring. So they put it into canals. And so one day a week, they'll send it down there. And another day of the week, it goes down there. And then all of these trees that are growing, could be citrus fruit. I think bananas will grow too. Aside from sycamore trees, remember the story. So this is the water. So we envisage a tree that's planted perhaps beside a canal, some kind of stream. We're not sure of quite its nature. It's not a river, but it could be a canal. So we're like that. Now, we'll go on to the next slide, where I want to make the big point of the sermon. So if you missed it all so far, this is my point this morning. The well-being of the trees or the tree is determined by the stream. If you think about that, the tree planted by a stream is taken care of. The tree is taken care of by the stream. It's a supply of water. So then my question that I keep asking myself, I know it's a simile, so what would the streams be? Because this is not really so much about trees, it's about you and me, isn't it? It's about the person as happy as the person who. So I'm thinking, it says here the law of the Lord, the instruction of the Lord. So I'm thinking that the psalm is talking about being planted by the instruction of God and how God's instruction to us helps us grow and be well and so on. And I'm thinking also possibly that it's talking about, we might include the book of Psalms, the whole book of Psalms, which become a book of instruction. So fed by that, you and I are like that tree who is fed by God's message of salvation and the gospel and so on, right? Now, I mention here wisdom, and the book of Psalms is a collection written over a very long period of time. Perhaps it could be as much as 700 years. Now, there is a psalm, by the waters of Babylon, we sat down when we wept when we remembered Zion, which Boney M. made into a great song, right? When you go home, Google that. Boney M., by the waters of Babylon, and then you'll be singing it all day. So that psalm, particular psalm, comes from when God's people were away in exile in Babylonia. By the waters of Babylon, it could be like a canal, because they had canals there too. So that psalm belongs to, would be the 6th century BC, whereas some of the oldest psalms may go back to the time of David, which would be 1,000. So here we have in this collection of 150 songs, the experience of God's people over 600 or 700 years. All of their experiences are shared with us as we read the Psalter. They're not just nice little poems. They come out of the grit and the difficulties of God's people over a very long period of time, and so they have something to teach us. They teach us wisdom, I would say. Now, I know, when I say streams of water, I don't know about you, but my mind just leapt to John chapter 4, where Jesus is talking with the woman by the well, remember? John chapter 4. And it's an amusing chapter because it goes from misunderstanding to understanding, which is the way John sets up these conversations as a method of teaching. So we go from misunderstanding to understanding. Jesus says he's going to give her, if she had asked, he would have given her the waters of life. What are the waters of life in the chapter? I think probably he's talking about himself or the Spirit. So those waters are our waters too in the light of the New Testament. My mind just sort of leapt there. And then finally, reveling in gratitude, the treasure. So we ought to be delighted, we ought to be overjoyed that God has revealed himself and given us instruction. We delight in that. We have these connotations, right, in our heads about the Old Testament generally and about the New Testament. We think of the New Testament as gospel, the Old Testament as law, and we're not very keen on that, so we lump the Psalms with that. It all belongs back there. But, you know, the people who gathered on Pentecost were celebrating. They come to a big party to celebrate the giving of the law on Mount Sinai. Yeah. So it's time to party, folks, because God has given us this instruction. So we can go to the next slide now, please. Because this is my conclusion. They're planted by streams of water. That's you and me. And streams of water are God's instruction. Could include the Psalms. If you look to the person beside you, you know, whoever's sitting, you may have to look down the whole pew, Michelle, down to the end. You may have to look down to the end of the pew. That's okay. Just look around you. What are you seeing? What you are seeing are the streams of water, some of the streams of water, I would say. Those things would buoy us up, those things that feed us, those things that help us make it what we are, make us what we are, and the way that we should be, that is the righteous. Now, it goes on to speak about, for the wicked, this is not the scene. But we're primarily interested in those who want to do the will of God, who are the righteous. And so it goes on to say, they give their fruit in their season, they're productive, so many different ways. In all that they do, they prosper. Things will go well. They may not go always well, but they'll go well, certainly overall. And then finally, the Lord watches over, that's Yahweh, watches over the way of the righteous. Watches over here. The old translation, the King James may have said, knows the way of the righteous. It is that particular verb, which means know as well. But it also comes to mean watch over, to take care of, you know, to take care of someone. And that's the sense here, watches over us. Now, this particular word, watches over us, Hebrew is a lot different than our language, English, especially with regard to tenses of verbs. Sorry, I'm taking you back to your grammars, aren't I? We have verbs that are present tense. We have verbs that are imperfect. I was watching TV, you know. And then we have verbs that are just, you know, like that. I kicked the ball. It's gone. It's over with. But Hebrew's not like that. There are Hebrew verbs which refer to something that happens like that. And then there are verbs which are continuity of action. So they don't have tenses the way we have tenses. But this particular word is a participle, which participles are about continuous action. I am going, I am watching. And that's what this is. God, Yahweh, continually watches over the way, that is the life, their lifestyle of the righteous. So we have someone watching over us. Willie Nelson sings that song, Someone to Watch Over Me. That's an old song, isn't it? You know it. And we all long for somebody to watch over us and take care of us. We never outgrow that, do we? We're always interested in someone who will care about us and watch over us. And so here the psalm ends with this note that the Lord God, Yahweh, God from Mount Sinai, the God who watched down on the cross, that this God is always looking out for us and watching over us, providentially watching over us. And so that's what I was working on with the streams of water, meditation. Now, we say that, or we used to say, maybe do we still say this, you are what you eat. Do people still say that? Okay. So people, we used to say that. So you are what you eat. Or I shouldn't make it personal for you. I should say, I am what I eat. But there's also, you are what you think, isn't there? You are what you think about. You are what you think about. At the end of the book of Philippians, Paul tells them, you know, whatever is good and just and so on, think about those things. So you and I, what do we think about? We are what we think. And if we think about the good things, then we'll be encouraged to take that way. All right? I've checked the program because, do I know what comes next? Oh, I have a final slide, don't I? This beautiful scene, and there's the simile. We're like a tree planted by streams of water.